Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to this week's episode of Safe Room, a horror video game podcast and proud member of Bloody Disgusting's Bloody FM podcast network. I'm your host, Jay Krieger.
And I'm the other one, Neil Bolt.
And this week we're fastening our bulkheads and sinking our comms before being submerged into the aquatic dread of Stasis Bone Totem. From developer The Brotherhood, Stasis Bone Totem is a horror point-and-click adventure game in which salvagers Mac, Charlie, and Moses stumble upon an abandoned oil rig concealing a secret lab full of horrors beyond their imagination. So Neil, my first question for you this week is, did you play Stasis Bone Totem on your Steam Deck? And if so, did you do it to solely make me jealous of being able to play this game on the go?
Yes.
<That's it>. I figured as much.
Well, yeah, it was the most convenient. In fairness, mostly on TV though. So it's not like I played much on handheld. I'd have to have time to do that in places. I could be away and hidden to do it. But no, it was definitely a comfortable experience being able to do it that way.
It was the type of game where, as I was playing it obviously last year and really enjoyed it, but then getting to come back to it, and now the Steam Deck obviously being out, I was just thinking like, oh man, this is the type of game, if there was maybe four other games like this that were Steam Deck verified, I would probably buy a Steam Deck almost immediately just because of the potential of playing this game on the go, you know, in the comfort of bed or sofa or whatever. But at the same time, like just the idea of those visuals being condensed a little bit more, not to say that, you know, playing on my laptop or whatever was a detriment to the experience, but just, you know, it is such a well-refined sort of world and just the graphical style is right up my alley that to think about it on that handheld would just be like the most pristine version. But before we were recording, you and I briefly were talking about the fact that, you know, this is an entry in what is, I'll say, like an anthology series in that this is the third of the Stasis games, but at the same time, it's not a continuation of any one narrative, also not a continuation of any one setting. But it's more about, I think, sort of like the flavor of an adventure game, point and click adventure game that Stasis is, which is, you know, dropping the player into a world that is, you know, hostile to the player, might be familiar to the protagonist, but at the end of the day, it is a world filled with, you know, I think failed experiments that have costed countless lives and whatnot. And the player is sort of dropped into this hell. And it's not always like an environment that is filled with monsters or anything along those lines, but it is a world that is filled with the ramifications of like human error, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And done in a very traditional sort of old school way, I'd say, you know, in terms of like, you have these like high res, very detailed cutscenes. You can tell generally, you know, if the whole game was that, I think it would be a very janky game thing, but it's used sparingly in just the right places. And like I said, that's a throwback to what games used to be like, where it's like, hey, look at all these wonderful scenes that. And you look at the game itself and it'd be just like, yeah, there's your little man there. There's your backgrounds and things like that. But obviously, because it's a modern game, it looks great either way. It's just a different kind of great. And I think, but I say either way, it's like multiple different sort of viewpoints, really, because you have a switch to first-person perspective in certain, you know, puzzle elements and things and interactions. So, yeah, I do think that it does a good job in that. It really does just sort of remind me of that without really, you know, being nostalgia bait.
Yeah, and I think for, you know, anybody that is as much a fan of horror films as their horror games, a really great reference point for this would be, you know, Underwater from 2022, with Kristen Stewart in it, right? Because it's this idea of going through this facility that on paper or just, you know, on a first glance is nothing out of the ordinary. It's an oil rig. But the more that you investigate the facility and whatnot and the horrors that are beneath the surface really come to light, that's like a pretty good reference point, I think. But at the same time, from a gameplay standpoint and a world building standpoint, I was really impressed with, you know, Stasis Bone Totem introducing the world in a way that didn't feel fantastical right off the bat, right? Because it begins with this sort of, you know, ominous, we're investigating this massive oil rig from this company Kane that, you know, is abandoned. And the fact that you're trying to uncover the mystery of where people went, but then, you know, as you explore the facility and you travel beneath the oil rig and the, you know, the surface, you know, it transforms the experience into something completely different. And it becomes more fantastical, more horror focused, more mad scientist focused. But at the same time, like, I think the legwork in the first hour or two of the game before you get to that aspect of it, like, that's what allows it to be sold in a way that feels like they're not front loading the experience with the best that's to come. And that's not to say the opening hour or something is not, you know, filled with great puzzles, great character interactions and these things, but it is almost, it plays out kind of like a film, right? The fact that you're following this structure of uncovering the mystery and whatnot, but it acts like a tutorial, I think, for the mechanics of this game, which while the game might look like a traditional point and click adventure, the ways in which they handle the party and also the lack of combat in this game, I was really, really impressed with, you know, first and foremost, this, you have those three characters, as we mentioned, you've got the husband and wife team, which is Mac and Charlie, and then they're aided by their super toy bear, affectionately named Moses, who is, you know, has this sort of mind of a child, but at the same time is this expert hacker and whatnot. And, you know, the relationship between those three characters is probably my favorite aspect of this game. But I guess for you, like, how did you feel about the sort of characters and them be, they're sort of informing various aspects of the world?
Yeah, I mean, it gives you that sort of everyman approach. The fact that you reference underwater is quite an important point, because obviously underwater borrows a lot from Alien, which, you know, again, is just like, one's everyman in, man in space, one's everyman at the bottom of the ocean. It's, and both coming into contact with something horrific. And in all three cases, it's about building that sort of normalcy and drudgery of it all. And, well, probably underwater doesn't do it as well as the other two examples. Here, I really liked that opening a lot, because, funny enough, there was an interview this week about the Chinese Room's new game, Still Wakes the Deep, which is also set on an oil rig where weird cosmic horror stuff is happening. And they were saying about, you know, making that first hour about just the oil rig and just the ambience and like the sounds and things like that. They talked to all these people who'd worked on oil rigs about how that was, and that sounded really cool, because, you know, I'd just gone through it with this game, you know, that opening hour or so, where it is just so, you know, you really can soak up everything about the environment, you know, the descriptive text, the conversations between them, really selling the idea of this place. And, you know, when aquatic horror's done well like that, I really enjoy it. Something about oil rigs and places at sea like that, they work so well, I think, for not just for cosmic horror, because, you know, it generally ends up being some sort of, you know, sea-based thing, but yeah, man-made structures in the ocean, it's just like you've gone, like in space, it's you've gone where you shouldn't, that sort of thing, and you know, somewhere underneath was the consequences of doing so. But the quietness, you know, nothing really going on, them sort find their way in and learning all those little abilities whilst you're getting to know them and their all that, it's a nice gentle way to get into it, you know. I'm glad it wasn't just like, yeah, multiple intensity. It was I was already setting myself up being kind of game, like you said, where it's like I was sure there was going to be combat to a degree, you know, and it wasn't really that kind of game. I'm glad, because I think it didn't need it. But yeah, that is such a, probably one of the best sort of scene setters I've played in a horror game for a while, I think, in terms of just like getting that atmosphere. And I think, you know, bias about what I like about it aside, you know, in terms of the environment and what it is, it is just, like you say, it plays out in a cinematic fashion, but also like a book in terms of just like not skimping on the detail, not feeling clunky and exposition heavy, just naturally flowing, knowing it doesn't have to worry about runtime. It'll go and let you go as long as you want to, as long as it takes to figure out. And yeah, it really does just set up the rest of it so well.
You know, I'm not going to say that I am a point-and-click adventure purist, that I've played the best of the best, but my big sort of bar for these types of games is Planescape Torment, right? That's a game that, you know, obviously featured combat, but more importantly, I think for what makes that game such a stellar standout of point-and-click adventure games is the fact that you have this wonderful, and it's almost like a tome of, you know, descriptive text for the world itself. Mm-hmm. You know, there's tons of detail in the writing. It feels like you're reading a novel while you're playing this interactive game, obviously. Yeah. And that was something that Stasis Bone Totem absolutely blew me away with. You know, I'll come back to the party in a minute because that's also one of my favorite aspects of the game. But what I absolutely love about this game is the writing and how descriptive it is.
Yes.
But more importantly, you know, a lot of the writing and, you know, things that you can learn about the world are not forced down your throat, which stops you from sort of like feel like you're reading a book the entire time. It's more based on the player and how much they want to get involved with the world, how much it, you know, it happens to be that this is a setting that is right up our alley. It's a subgenre of horror that is exactly what we're into. So yeah, we're more inclined, but I think that for people that maybe are looking for, you know, it just happens to be, hey, I like point and click adventure games, I'm going to play this one. If you just wanted to, you know, make a beeline for the puzzles and follow, quote unquote, the main story of the game, that's one thing. But for people like us that already are invested before you even started playing, because of the reasons that we said, you know, there is so much flavor text for this world, interacting with objects that at the end of the day, they don't have any bearing on the player's progression. If anything, it's just informing the player's own curiosity about the world itself.
Yes.
So when you're exploring the world, there's those basically threads that will project from your character's body if you put on the scan mode, and those threads are blue and they're green. If the thread is green, it's tied to an object and you can basically follow the thread to where the object is. If you hover your mouse over it, again, it has this, usually it's a lengthy description of either an object in the environment or just, you know, something that's happening to be there. So sometimes it might be just a shelf, which is very innocuous, but at the same time, it could be like a pool of blood or, you know, various oddities that are within that environment. And granted, the pacing of this game, environments become filled with more and more, you know, horrifying ramifications of capitalism and these things and experiments, which, you know, we'll get into. But, and the blue threads are objects that the player can interact with. So that leads you basically right to the puzzles or right to a door. But I found myself seeking out all of the green threads before I ever went to any blue threads in a given environment because of the fact that, again, it's informing my understanding of this world previous to, you know, the player's arrival and whatnot. And I found that to be so incredibly rewarding. And that's not going to be rewarding unless the writing is of a caliber that actually feels rewarding, right? If it was just basic sort of descriptions, I'd be like, okay, well, I don't need to read about a shelf because there's no item for me to pick up there. So why would I do that? But that's a testament, I think, to the quality of the writing here, and that everything is given, I suppose, the sense that it's important, even if maybe it isn't really. Again, like the way in which a shelf is described is going to be giving you some type of context for the environment that that shelf is in, or an activity that occurred in that area, or something along those lines. And then obviously, you know, you come across some horrific experiment, there's some great flavor text to go with that down the line. But that leads me into something about the party that I love, which is the fact that each of the characters that you're playing as are never in the same room. They're spread out across the ship and you can interchange between them at will. And what I loved about that was the fact that no character interacts with an object the same way. So if I'm playing as Mac and I hover over a shelf, he's going to have descriptive text of that shelf that is in his own sort of vernacular or have his cadence behind it. Likewise with Moses, who plays, again, has the mind of a child in terms of processing the world around them, but is this, you know, supreme hacker type of thing. So, you know, Moses also has some of my favorite dialogue.
Oh, yeah.
When he interacts with, you know, an object like a hypodermic needle, the player obviously knows what that's used for. But Moses's text for that is this a doctor's needle? I don't like doctors. Like little things like that that show their personality. Another one was when you hover over like a key card, you know, the player knows I'm going to stick that into a computer terminal. But Moses's description of it is just, I can fit the entire thing in my mouth. Like little things like that, that show off, you know, that character's personality and whatnot.
Yeah.
Is one of those aspects that, again, you know, you take the writing in this game and it feels serving in terms of like the player understanding more about the characters, but at the same time reinforcing what they already know about them, which I found to be really imperative to, you know, these characters that basically, you know, they're very reactionary because they're in this situation, but at the same time, like that reactionary nature of them does not feel as if it is one note, I suppose. I feel like it feels specific to them rather than just, you know, generic generated text.
Yeah, because I think a cultured thing about this is they have an expectation of where they've gone into, you know, even with what's going on. It's like they know what they're doing. It's not like literally alien. They are, you know, well-versed in doing this kind of thing. So that informs the way they think. And just to go back to Moses, yeah, that I agree. You know, in terms of like line delivery, I mean, without spoiling the scene in particular, you know, there's a particular abomination that you have to collect milk from. And you just would tell the line, children, not drink that milk. And it's just like, it was just like, oh man, yeah, just that sort of blunt innocence sort of thing, you know, man child, it works so well as like a bit of light humor in. Again, it's, you know, very dark and dreary and grisly grim at times. But it's just that it's a good dynamic to have.
Yeah, and I think that what I really liked too is that outside of the major narrative beats or even some of the flashbacks that kind of give you an indication of a trauma that these characters have all endured previous to their arrival at the oil rig and whatnot, I like still that you get a good sense of what their relationship is. Like, Charlie is very optimistic, right? Moses is clearly naive. But then you have Mac, who is very pessimistic, right? And has almost sort of an antagonistic relationship with Moses. But over the course of whatever 10 hours this game takes to beat, you still, through their dialogue, it feels very genuine. It doesn't feel contrived, right? It's Mac basically, you know, Moses is a reminder of what this family has lost. But at the same time, like, Mac is annoyed at the fact that, you know, there is somebody else in this crew that can do something that he can't. So you see their antagonistic relationship, but that antagonism is only one-sided, obviously, because of, again, how naive and childlike Moses is. Moses basically responds to everything by saying, I am very smart for a bear, and like little things like that, which again, after Mac kind of like takes a jab at him or something, and that's Moses's follow-up, you're like, oh, like feeling for him almost. But that's indicative of a relationship that at least doesn't feel, while it is scripted, it doesn't feel like it is just the generic sort of scripting for characters and their relationships. It at least feels like it's informed by a history. And to have that history be front and center from the opening moments of this game, again, it speaks to a developer and a development team that is very sort of in tune with what they want to go for in terms of like what is unique about a Stasis game. And I think that that's why, you know, while we haven't played the previous games, I did go back and look at, you know, read a little bit about them. And that's been the through line, it seems, for these games, is that it's very personable writing and it's writing that feels like it's a novel rather than just generic games writing, if you will.
Yeah, and I think it's noted, isn't it? They've got a screenplay written by someone from Hollywood. So, and where that could be like the detriment of a game, you know, in terms of like writing for the wrong thing, I think this is one of those examples of someone who clearly understood the kind of thing they were doing. In an age where we are living, you know, with video games trying to be more and more cinematic, you know, in terms of visual style, And in terms of like how the person playing them interacts with them, where it's maybe a bit looser and easier. Something that's paced like this, but still has that feeling, it is genuinely impressive, because that's a very difficult thing to do right. And it clearly works, you know, so well that they've managed, and to split it between three viewpoints as well like that, have these three very distinct perspectives and dialogues, and have it flow in a way that, as I said, doesn't feel like it's just exposition from one person or people just going, what's going on? Why is this happening? Sort of thing for six, 7 hours. It's, you get a sense of them doing their job, little bits and pieces here and there that sort of give you an idea of things that have gone on before in their life, things that have gone, things that might impact them here, the thing with Moses and the fear of water, basically, which is not the best thing to have in a place like this. But having that character as well in Moses is an interesting one, because it's an absurd character in a world that feels very grounded, and normally you expect that to be played for my God, a talking bear sort of kooky dooky sort of thing. But it doesn't really go there. It's just kind of accepted as one of those things that happens, and you don't necessarily know from the start why that is. And I like that. Right. It's just there. It's a weird thing in the world. It's their version of the world, and it's perfectly normal to have a bear that like a child.
Well, it's the type of thing where, you could either have that history spelled out or implied throughout various dialogue, or you could have just breadcrumbs that indicate a larger history, which, personally, I'm fine with that, because, there's only so much time in a game to, spell everything out. And at the same time, if you feel the need to explain everything, then you might run into the issue of overwriting, which... Personally, I didn't find that to be the case with this game. I know some people have in what I was reading online. But at the same time, again, I found the world so engrossing. I found these characters very personable. So the notion of it being overwritten is kind of like laughable in my opinion, just because of the fact that I am so invested in this already that I want more, right? Like I said, that's why it took me so long to finally finish this game, because of the fact that, I'm enjoying all of this dialogue and all of this flavor text. So I am interacting with everything I come across and reading it because of, again, the variety in the different descriptors of things based on character personality and whatnot.
And the logic of it is there as well, that they'd be talking all the time because they are in separate places needing to communicate what's going on. And that with the way things go, it's like to not be alone in that situation as well. And to have a comforting voice to be there. People yapping away while they're together, that would be one thing. But when they are apart, it makes more sense like that in the context of what they're doing. So I can get why that might be annoying, but if people don't like dialogue to be that there, but I think it's perfectly reasonable in terms of what they've done and why they've done it.
I want to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to dive a little bit more into the party, our cast of characters, puzzles, and of course, a little bit more of that wonderful, wonderful dread-inducing atmosphere of Stasis Bone Totem, but more on that in a moment.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And we are back from our break. And, early on you said that, this game, we were expecting to have combat. It very clearly does not have combat. And when I learned that, I didn't necessarily think that it would be an issue, because again, we've talked plenty of times about horror games that are able to be successful despite the fact that they lack combat. And we've seen plenty of creative solutions around that lack of combat. For a point and click adventure game, again, maybe it's because I had more of a limited experience with those games. All the ones I've played have been combat focused for the most part in that regard. But for this game, what I was really impressed with was the fact that despite the party never has an opportunity to be distinguishable by specific combat roles, what they do have that distinguishes them are character specializations, which gives each party member a sense of individuality, you know, in lieu of traditional combat roles, which I found to be absolutely perfect in terms of this particular type of experience. You know, for Mac, he has a special ability where if you give him objects, he can break, bend, or crush them, which then allows you to manipulate items that you find that then can be used to solve various puzzles and be combined to solve puzzles. Charlie is able to combine and repair items for the same purpose. And then Moses is just like this pristine hacker that has never met a computer that he can't have his way with. And, you know, I think that that was a really important way to, again, reinforce character individuality and to give them a sense of, I suppose, you know, an impact on gameplay rather than just having narrative impact or being differentiated through narration, as we said, you know, with their various dialogue options and these things. So, you know, in that regard, I was impressed in terms of like how they're able to allow each of these characters to play a very specific role and to never really let the player, I suppose, stick with any one character for too long. Right. And it kind of reinforces this idea that despite the fact they're spread across the station, they have to, you know, still be working with one another. And that's made possible by what is, I think, and I wrote about this for Dread Central last year, probably one of the most important new features that I've experienced in a point and click adventure game such as this. And that is in this game, it's called the Quantum Storage Device, which basically is a future tech that allows each of the party members to pass items between the three of them, regardless of whether they're in the same room or not. And I thought that that was brilliant, to be honest. The fact that you don't have the usual hiccups of an adventure game when you're exploring these massive environments where it's like, okay, I'm going to send a guy in this direction, send somebody in that direction. Oh, I found the puzzle piece we need. And then there's 10 minutes of backtracking or something along those lines, waiting for characters to be in the same spot. And with this game, the fact that it doesn't abide by that sort of typical framework, like I found this to be a game that I breezed through on the second replay just because I was already familiar with the mechanics and all of those things. So when it came time to solving puzzles, I was just, you know, zipping between characters, sending items to one so the other one could break it or combine it with something. And it just, it felt for a much more refined, and it's the type of like modern updating on a very classic genre that we've talked about in the past and wanting examples of that. And I found that this, you know, nails that in that regard in terms of pushing it forward while not sort of like undoing what makes these games such as this genre such a standout.
Yeah, I mean, I was tentative about how it would all work out first, but you know, the characters getting further afield, and it very quickly sort of gives you the idea of, oh, no, no, you can use this device to send things between them. And I thought, that's great, because I think as much as it is taking its time pace-wise, it would take away from the narrative and, you know, the cinematic feel of it a bit if you were having to do the backtracking. It would then start to become more of a survival horror than a point-and-click. And I don't know if it needed to be. You know, it's got a lot of the way it looks and is portrayed, but that works better like that. You know, I think that system is like, it's often hard, I suppose, to look at the easy solution. But yeah, we should do that. Just make an excuse for why they can do it like that, why they can give stuff to each other. Whereas in some cases, I think, especially back when you kind of had to sort of pad time, you know, and because of how much you had to spend on making these things, that you would go, oh, you know, okay, so we'll make them walk back here, come back here, and go around there again, back and forth, back and forth. Yeah, they had to do that, but so they would design that in mind. They would say, well, okay, so we won't have a convenient reason to do items and things like that, or easy solutions or whatever. I think it's doubly necessary because of the way the game is structured in terms of like puzzles and stuff. It's like the puzzles themselves are enough, you know, like that, you know, to, you don't need to be adding traipsing around extra just to, you know, deal with it. You know, they are challenging enough without that. So I think that would just give you a sense of frustration that would have been unfair on the game and the way it's paced.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, while this game can be quite difficult at times, whether that is based on the complexity of the puzzles or maybe, you know, some of the puzzles are a little too vague in terms of what needs to be done with them, I found that, you know, having that system in place and it being a constant that you have to be doing that, you have to be switching between characters frequently and you also have to be sending items between them, you at least feel by the time you get to the more complex portions of the game that, you know, it's reinforcing that you need to be, you know, utilizing all of the characters and exploring and, you know, trying to combine all of these items in various ways, utilizing those specializations. So to the degree that, like, outside of maybe three or four puzzles, I really didn't ever need to look anything up or struggle with anything too much, just because of the fact that I was so accustomed to experimenting to the degree that I already was with those characters and their abilities and whatnot. Which I think also, again, you know, to talk about replacing something like combat, which I definitely don't think would have fit here. If anything, it just, it reinforces the importance of the characters and those varying identities and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Which I think, again, is, you know, if you're going to have a party that is only three members, you really do have to have that be what is probably the most refined aspect of the game and whatnot.
Yeah. And just while we're on that, actually, about, you know, the party, I think something has to be said about the, you know, the aesthetic of this game in terms of like the UI in general. It's just like, it feels, without being biomechanical, despite there being so much biomechanical stuff in this, it has a living feeling to it. You know, it's constantly busy moving. You go into like log menus and things like that. You have those little talking heads that, you know, they're not actually saying anything, but they're like those sort of crummy video feed type things. And, you know, I was talking to Andrew King about this, about lighting in video games, especially in horror video games, and how certain technology, when things are dark, it works so beautifully and looks so great if you use the right shades of darkness and shadow to make, and it really accentuates the feel and the believability of that. And I think even in those little like video feed things of people's faces, even with the crew you've got, like that, something about how they sort of disguise some of it really does just make it feel cinematic in a really simple way. And yeah, all throughout the game, it's just like everything feels, you know, it's there, very clear to see, but it feels so natural. It could stay, you know, considering how busy it feels to look at first, you would think it would, you know, be a bit distracting. But no, I think it's it's just jostling and bumping along in the places where it's supposed to. You know, I think just to sort of give you a gentle reminder, I think, in a subtle way, rather than going for the, here's a pop-up that says, do this, do this, do this. And yeah, I think the overall aesthetic is just, you know, again, reminds me of those sort of early CRPGs and point-and-click adventures, you know, in terms of grungy, stungy feel, but all this biomechanical industrial stuff, which just looks fantastic in that style. And, you know, here it's sort of more modernized, cleaner, updated, but still feels scuzzy, you know, like that. Talking about Fallout earlier, we were, and, you know, those early Fallout games, similar sort of aesthetic in terms of like the menus and stuff and games like that. So yeah, there's something about it that just looks right, you know, like that. And thematically, in keeping with the game and like the technology that they sort of hint about, you know, around it as well. So it fits on two levels, you know, in terms of for the player and also for how narratively it works together. Like we've just discussed about, you know, in the inventory, being able to flip between different people and give different items to each other like that. It's, yeah, just, I think, a very understated part of the game in terms of just making you, you know, giving you that level of immersion, you know, beyond the story and the atmosphere. It's just everything in front of you is just there properly, feeling like a part of the world.
Yeah, and I think that the fact that those portraits of characters when they're having those, you know, communications with one another, the fact that they're not stagnant, but at the same time, they don't become a focal point that's distracting. As you said, it kind of just like, it gives a production value to this entire game that I think makes it feel like a bigger game in terms of the production value and the scale than it actually is. Because again, it's like a relatively small team, but this feels like a game that has a lot more people on its development team than it actually probably does because of those things, because of the fact that even in those little motions or little sort of directions that they move around in those portraits, like it makes it feel like you're actually talking to another person rather than just a static portrait, which would just reinforce the fact, yeah, somebody else is talking, but I don't really even, it's not going to draw my eye at all. And it draws your eye just enough that you tune in a little bit more. You're almost paying attention more to a line of dialogue. And, you know, we should also note, like, the voice acting in this game is really terrific as well for each of those characters. But, you know, even from stuff like the UI, like you mentioned, each inventory hub that each of the characters has is slightly different based on who you're playing as. The most notable one being, you know, Moses, and his has a little icon that says Smart Bear on it. So it's almost like, oh, this is like a label that's probably underneath his fur or something. But, you know, furthermore, it's just like it's giving more personality or at least distinguishing features to each character, whether or not they end up being, you know, these massive changes or not. Like, it just ends up making you remember or reinforcing the fact that these are three separate characters and these are their personalities almost playing through throughout that. But even stuff that pops up on screen, like you come across any number of PDAs and the PDAs, each one of them is different. Some of them have graffiti scrawled on them. Some of them are like pristine. Some of them are somewhat damaged. And the presentation of this game is, you know, again, it's really, really impressive. And, you know, we've barely talked about the environments, but it being isometric is really, again, like the most cinematic way that you could have this game world be viewed through because of the fact that, you know, it is such a highly detailed environment, but at the same time, it has that cinematic angle that, again, it kind of captures the sort of massiveness of the facilities that you're going to be exploring in, you know, a majority of the game. And I think that, you know, that transition from the familiar in the opening hour of the game to the foreign in the back half of the game, but at the same time, it has this grandiose scale to it, but not at the cost of detail in the environment, is, you know, a quality of this game. Again, it makes it feel like it's a much bigger production than it actually is, which, if anything, you know, brings us to the puzzles and whatnot. And what I loved about this was the fact that, you know, in typical fashion with games such as this, when you interact with a object that is tied to a puzzle, you know, it's going to cut to first person then, which then blows up the environment that the puzzle is in. But at the same time, like, that detail, if anything, only increases. And at the same time, what it does is it allows the player to see more of those biomechanical horrors that they'll be investigating throughout their, you know, exploration of the station and whatnot. And those are the most horror-centric moments of the game. And I absolutely love the fact that they're able to kind of like press the player's face almost into these horrors that have been going on and these experiments and whatnot. Like, early on, you come across a cyborg, basically, that is clearly, you know, has some human parts in it along with the cybernetic components. And you're just like having to rifle through the guts of it. But at the same time, you get this breakdown of each of the parts that you can interact with. And those have really great descriptors while also revealing, you know, more squirmy moments sometimes with, you know, either a cutscene that gets triggered. And there are some cutscenes in this game and they feel like they are injected right at the moments that need to, moments that emphasize something about the world or an action, but they're not, there's not an overabundance of them, which I think is smart because of the fact that it doesn't allow their potency, if you will, to really kind of like fall to the wayside.
Yeah. Again, when I say it feels like a throwback, that like in those old games, it feels like a reward to get a cutscene. You know, like that. It doesn't feel like part, and, you know, here's another cutscene, here's another cutscene. It is very much like, you've earned this, yeah, you know, have this, and they make the most of it, you know, I think, especially when they have to show something that really sort of dive into why something is disgusting and just mad to look at. You know, there's, I think there's a scene about halfway through the game like that where this thing gets just ripped apart, and it's just, it's such a up close and graphic scene, and it's like, and the visual style that I've just been talking about, you know, in terms of like the use of shadow, it looks just sublime. And it really just impacts you, because as you said, they use it perfectly. You know, they use every time there's something. It's like, you know, when we say it's like a book in terms of like descriptors and things like that, all right, that's fine, it does those that job very fine. But sometimes there are bits where it's like, we get your imagination could get this, but maybe it'd be better if we showed you for in terms of like the cinematic side of the storytelling. And that's when it happens. You pretty much never get a scene that is basic and, you know, like just here's a character walking into a room looking around and then we're back to the action thing. It is always something meaningful. Yeah, and that's exactly what you do if you can have, you know, a smattering of cutscenes like that. And it's a good use of budget. I'd say there's a lot of, yeah, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors used here to make things, like you say, appear bigger like that. And I was really impressed with that, especially with that isometric viewpoint. It does go back in my mind to, you know, the sort of horror games and the fixed camera thing of like, it looks good for a reason. It's because of what you don't have to do, you know, with the camera, with the environment. What you don't have to show means you can make other bits look great. And they really do. I mean, there's the detail. And I think when we were talking at the beginning about like going on Steam Deck, like, honest to God, like going from the big screen to the Steam Deck, like the detail looks just so cool on a smaller screen, especially an OLED screen, you know, like that. Just like,
sure,
phenomenal. You know, like, it's amazing how much they've done with so little. I think it's the cutscenes in a certain wrong light moments. Yeah, you can tell that, you know, they aren't quite at that highest quality. But it's the sophisticated way they use that is more impressive than, you know, like the technical achievement sort of thing. It's like that. It's
right.
It feels more rough and ready. It feels more like, you know, like an 80s practical effects heavy thing film rather than a,
yeah,
a modern CG slop fest, which is great. That's what you want. You want something that feels tangible, something that feels like you could reach out and touch it like that. And even in a video game. And, it does, you know, it often does, especially as it gets into those sections that are more, you know, full of mess, effectively. And, yeah, it just looks beautifully putrid. And I was so impressed with that. You know, it's just that the whole achievement of that in terms of, you know, not like, oh, they've pushed the system to limits and all that sort of stuff. There's that kind of ambition, but this is more of a knowing what you've got and working the best way with it. And I think, yeah, like you said, having even little things like those portraits and talking is like taking lessons from certain like simple games like that. Like Persona 5 is one I always think of, where there's a lot of busy activity in terms of conversations, slightly moving portraits of people as you're talking to them. And that's great because it makes the conversation more interesting and there's a lot of talking. Game. So yeah, using a similar system here, you know, but in a less subtler way, it is just great. You know, I like seeing games that sort of evolve these ideas and take them in different ways. Yeah, so yeah, just spellbinding at times that, you know, how well they've managed to put this all together.
Yeah, and I mean, if there was an over-reliance on cutscenes just because you can, again, that wouldn't be an indication of a group of people that really understand this genre, right? Because I think about when I was playing, you know, the old school Fallout games, and it was like those games very rarely had cutscenes, but when they did, it was an impactful moment, not just because they were rare, but because of what they were emphasizing about something that was happening narratively or an action that was occurring during, you know, a specific milestone in that story. And to see this game do that, and to, you know, take it a step further and tie it mostly to like big actions that are happening, sometimes you can start to see, I suppose, some of the, I don't want to say shortcomings, but I suppose maybe like technical limitations or budgetary limitations in them. But at the same time, they still are emphasizing exactly what they should be in that moment. And I think that, you know, an over-reliance or an over-direction of cutscenes or moments like that could certainly be a detriment that, again, would not allow this game to be as pristine of an example of people that understand what makes this subgenre so special and what makes it click, at the same time making it more modern, but never at the detriment of sort of the integrity of what they are paying homage to.
Absolutely.
But I guess, you know, in terms of like the puzzles, How did you find those? Were there outliers for you in terms of, you know, ones that maybe were memorable in terms of what they were asking of the player, or, you know, ones that maybe defied some logic, if you will?
Yeah, because, like, for the most part, you know, I think, you know, to be fair, without exception, I think they all logically fit, even in their illogic. You know, they all make sense in this game, in this world that you're in. But unfortunately, it does lead to these moments occasionally where you just, like, if you're not in the right mindset for a certain puzzle, it can be a right fucker. You know, you don't want to. You're just sat there just going, I can't figure this out. I'm not, like, I have to walk away. It isn't like a frustration with the game itself necessarily. It's more sometimes to think in a certain way, you have to be in a certain frame of mind. And there's probably the only point where the game doesn't, you know, keep its pace right, which is always difficult with puzzles, I think, because everyone's, but you know, you're all approaching a game with puzzles differently like that. To master that is just very difficult. Yeah, you know, like, it's what I always say, Valve mastered that, like Portal 2, you know, in terms of just like making these intricate puzzles that were, you could get, but would be challenging and make you think. But because they made you use your momentum and movement and thinking and look, you made you look, yeah, you know, really look at what you're doing. Here, yeah, I think once you get into the logic of the game itself, like however, I think it helps with the puzzles. I think, as you were saying earlier, it's like there are things that are easier on the second round. Yeah, you're used to the systems. I think certainly in the early hours, I found it difficult to remember. You know, that I could do this, this, and this, like that. You know, the inventory system, like being able to split between the different people. You know, sometimes would just elude me and think, oh, hang on, they've got this, they would do this. So of course, yeah, like that, because it's so accessible and simple an idea, you kind of forget that it's there, because most games wouldn't bother. They would try and make it a meal out of it. So by proxy, you're like, oh yeah, that works. And yeah, you know, that sometimes happens in games. But no puzzle really feels unfair. You know, I think it does just depend on mindset and a certain level of absurdism, I suppose. You know, I think someone described it as moon logic sometimes, you know, but you get that sense of it, and you just sort of roll your eyes at, yeah, okay, I get you, yeah, fine, like that. But yeah, but I think what the most impressive thing about it is that every puzzle feels like it's meant to be there in terms of the world and the story. You know, nothing feels like, oh, we just threw this, it seemed cool sort of thing. It all works into this, you know, descent, basically. You know, the whole story is like a descent. And as you do that, everything becomes hellish. Everything you have to do becomes more odd. You know, I think it escalates in just the right way like that.
No, I think that that's the best way to describe the puzzles and whatnot. And I would compare it to, you know, other horror games that we've played that are puzzle focused. And, you know, I never have struggled with horror games that have a puzzle in them that seems ridiculous or defies logic, so long as it feels fitting with the world that they have established. Mm. If you present a puzzle that doesn't feel reflective of the world, then sure, you might just look at it as being like an annoyance because of the fact that maybe it is vague or something along those lines. But in terms of like this game, as you said, the puzzles begin fairly simplistic enough, but they are indicative of the environment and the point in the story with which the player is at. So they do become, you know, more abstract, more fantastical, more ludicrous in some points later on, but that's because it's reflecting the player's journey throughout this world that is becoming more apparently, you know, strange and whatnot, and dealing with the supernatural and all of these things. So in that regard, yeah, like I didn't have a problem with any of the puzzles. And also it was kind of perplexed to read that maybe isn't the right way to put it. Some of the criticisms I'd read of this game were the puzzles being vague or people not knowing what to do with them and whatnot. But we haven't really mentioned like the scan feature for puzzles, which basically brings up little dots around parts of a puzzle that are interactable. And, you know, that speaks to like the tactile nature of this game with puzzles and whatnot. So you don't have to play with the scan feature. But at the end of the day, if you hit a wall with one, you just press that and then it tells you areas that you can interact with. And by that point in the game, the player should be familiar with the fundamentals and the fact that experimentation is the only way you're going to make it through this game, basically. And if anything, you know, it's like a minor detail on puzzles, but typically when I'm thinking about, you know, whether it's 90s or early 2000s survival horror games that have puzzles in them, often, you know, there wouldn't be an animation when you solve the puzzle, right? It would be like, oh, I've used the right key. So then part of this puzzle first person viewpoint, something would just fade away.
Yeah.
And again, to speak to Stasis Bone Totem's production value and it making it seem like it's a bigger game than it is, you have full animations when you're solving these puzzles. So for instance, if you're utilizing like an acetylene torch to get rid of a lock, you'll actually see the torch come in. It will, you know, do its thing and you'll see the lock in real time kind of fall off. And that's such a little detail, but at the same time, it speaks to the fact that where there needed to be polish or where there needed to be some extra sort of like oomph factor to something in this game, it seems like it's always there to the degree that it's differentiating itself just enough. It has just enough of these modern touches or polish to it that it feels like a game indicative of the time period in which it was released. But at the same time, it's playing by these very storied rules. And I think that that biomechanical and bioorganic and whatnot aspect of this game world and whatnot and the experiments that you find, it makes for some really fun, fucked up concepts for puzzles. Like there's a whole endoscopic section with a brain, basically, where you're sticking medical device into a brain, and then you have to go through these different sections of the brain and either stimulate, shunt, or sever the connection. And it's just like this great gross visual to go along with this medical theme puzzle. And I just love that idea of, you know, basically going through this mad scientist facility and then having to engage with these mad scientist experiments that not only have, you know, some smart logic to them, but at the same time, like there's just the gross stuff that, you know, us sickos want out of a horror game that really leans into that, you know, mad scientist theme.
Yeah. And like you were saying, that it's having that sort of solution bit come up sometimes in those ickier moments really does just rub your face in it almost, you know, like that. When I go back to that very particular reference to the milk scene, it's like, not shy about doing it, you know, and the way it happens. And I think it was that combined with that line that just like it just stuck in my head then, because like it's the imagery, the comment, and what you're doing. It's, you know, it's not the only time, but you know, it's one of many times where you have a touch of Cronenberg to it, where you're like, humor, body horror, and just weirdness in general just coming together. You know, like as much as it has the alien slash underwater stuff to it, that came up. I mean, and I suppose something I haven't referenced yet that should be quite obvious for anyone that knows me is, you know, Terror for the Deep, the XCOM game, immediately came to mind. And like, oof, yeah, so which is probably the genesis of much of my liking this kind of, you know, setting aesthetic. It's why I quite like Resident Evil Revelations, because it's mostly set on a boat and has very aquatic horror style enemies as well. So yeah, it's what a game reminds you of that without being exactly the same, but doing fresh, fun things in it, you can't help but just go, yes, this is for me. You know, to get hit with nostalgia without it being a nostalgia party is the best kind of experience. You know, a modern game taking from retro sensibilities in this way is absolutely the way that you should always try to do it, I think. You know, it's nostalgia can only take you so far. I think you have to look at why people were interested and enjoyed these aspects of things. And you know, as much as the puzzles might be the sugar in of people, I think that's part and parcel of it. You know, like that, I guess if I was playing this many years back, I'd have looked at it and thought it was very cool. But yeah, the puzzles probably would have been like, nope, well, I don't know what I'm doing yet, sort of thing. But it's like, because I was just notoriously terrible with puzzles. I think the only time I got, Resident Evil 2 was like the exception. It was like, said before, I read a fucking guide magazine page by page for months before playing it. So by the time I got it, it was easy street in that regard. But yeah, I'm glad to sort of get to play something fresh and new that feels like the sort of game I struggled with maybe when I was younger, but found really cool.
Yeah, well, I think that we deserve a medal this week for making it 52 minutes before mentioning Cronenberg or body horror. So,
or XCOM, so I guess.
Yeah, or XCOM. Because, we both know we could go on a tangent on those influences. But no, I think that in terms of a game that, is operating within this sort of like anthology universe and whatnot, and despite the fact we haven't played the other entries, which are not necessary, but it at least, and I said this to you before we were recording, Bone Totem feels like a game that a studio has been working towards in terms of perhaps people that have played the other Stasis games. They might say, oh, these themes or this is familiar, but that feels, I think, in Bone Totem to be the case because of how confidently and how polished so many of these elements are that we're talking about. I mean, I didn't even mention the score by Mark Morgan, which I find to be, just pitch perfect in every regard in terms of where the story is at in, the mystery of it. And then of course the horror of it. And we've kind of been vague and haven't dove in too much into, the narrative, but that's best to be experienced, fresh outside of kind of what we had talked about. But in terms of the reference points for this of being, alien or underwater-esque, this game carries on a concept in both of those films. Granted, it's done much better in Alien, which is, the horrors of capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that you have this corporation that's operating in sort of uncharted waters, if you will, and they don't have to abide by the same laws that people on land do. And then you find out all the fucked up ways in which they're exploiting that. You find out, the ways in which they use technology to prolong people's life, but that's only done so that way they can prolong their work for this company. And then you find out the ramifications of that and all of these different things and the cybernetic experiments and bioorganic experiments. And it just makes for a world that is so rich in detail and in horrors. But at the same time, even for people like myself that don't always necessarily get on with RPGs and whatnot that have an abundance of text, sometimes I find, a lot of this feels unnecessary or it doesn't necessarily support the aspects of this game that I find interesting. It's more telling narratives that or side stories that end up feeling inconsequential in a way that I kind of just feel like, oh, I wasted my time reading that random PDA or text log. And, I think with Stasis Bone Totem, it's the case where, again, it's a subgenre that both of us are very fond of. So it doesn't feel like a chore to read through all of the dialogue, all the PDAs that you come across. I'm reading descriptions of fucking shelves and I feel like I'm getting something out of it. And again, that speaks to the game never losing sight of the fact of the individuality of each of the three party members that you are controlling. And I remain incredibly impressed with the fact that a game that's completely devoid of combat is still able to have the same level of importance placed upon each character outside of a traditional combat role for the various reasons that we talked about. It was one of those things where maybe I'll go back and play the other Stasis games. My fear would be that, I wouldn't be able to get past perhaps the lack of polish that those have in comparison to Bone Totem. But if the level of writing is of the same caliber, I still feel like I would probably get something out of it. More so than maybe some other series where it's like you go back to the early days. I don't necessarily know that they have aged as well as they could have, but if anything, Bone Totem has kind of reinforced that the Brotherhood is a developer that I definitely am going to keep my eye on. And it's the type of thing where I would dive into their next project, regardless of if it was aquatic horror or even if it was, something maybe outside of the Stasis anthology world. Just because of how strong Bone Totem is. And, that's a reason why it was one of my favorite games of, I think was it last year or the year before that again? Blame it on COVID brain. Yeah, it was last year, last May. Yeah. We're coming up actually on the 1 year anniversary, but it's the type of thing where, it's such a strong narrative piece, adventure point and click horror piece that I would dive into whatever they choose to do next, regardless of if it's a continuation of the world of Stasis.
Yeah, absolutely. And to just sort of end on this, what I did like in having like an alien influence was that they managed to hide a little Easter egg in there, you know, alien wise, yeah. Which I was like very pleased to see and very briefly, but it was, little things like that are worth exploring the world for. And I think that's exactly why it's so rewarding to sort of interact with everything in this game, because you just don't know what interesting tidbit you'll find. So, and had it not been that kind of game, maybe you'd miss something. But I absolutely that aspect to it.
Absolutely. Well, from going from this week to chatting about one of my favorite games of last year, next week we're going to chat about one of my favorite games of the last 15 years, in that we'll be celebrating the 15th anniversary of Plants vs. Zombies, which I'm very excited to dive into. So that's going to do it for our chat on Stasis Bone Totem. And until next time, it's been a pleasure chatting horror with you for Safe Room.
Back at you. Until the next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Safe Room. If you enjoy the show, please rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter @SafeRoomPod for show updates. As always, our main episodes for Safe Room drop every Monday, but our bite-sized episodes of Horror Bites, our indie horror showcase, drop every Thursday. You can follow Horror Bites' Twitter account @HorrorBites_SR. You can join our Discord channel, Safe Room Podcast, to chat with us and other horror fans about the genre we all love. And finally, you can send emails to saferoompod@gmail.com if you'd like to share your thoughts on a game we have or are going to cover. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you guys next Monday.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM podcast network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.